Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Also listening to us on 88.1 WSBR in Lee, Lennox, and Stockbridge. Watching us on the PCTV Select app and on channel 1301. Access Pittsfield on your cable dial. I'm Sean Sayre, Executive Director here at PCTV and WTBR FM. I'm joined today by our co-host, Samuel Pascal, and he's going to be helping us with the interview today. We have a very special interview for you this morning. We have FCC Commissioner Ana Gomez on the program. She'll be joining us by Zoom, and very excited to have her and ask her questions today about many topics going on in communications and the internet and broadcasting, all kinds of good stuff. So Commissioner Gomez was nominated by President Joe Biden and confirmed as commissioner in 2023. Her term ends on July 1st, 2026. She's the lone Democrat on the commission. And in her career, she's also served with the National Economic Council, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, and in the Bureau of Cyberspace and Digital Policy. Welcome to WTBR's Morning Drive, and thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you. It's great to join you.
Well, so let's start off with a quick question about local radio and community radio, since we are broadcasting this here in the Berkshires of Massachusetts. We're conducting it on the small community radio station. And in this era of media consolidation, how important do you feel are independent hyper-local sources such as community radio? Where do you see these services fitting in today's media landscape?
Wow, that's such a great question, and it's such a current question given the level of media consolidation that we are seeing today. My fear with the amount of media consolidation that we are seeing is that we are losing community voices. We are losing local news. We are losing local content. And community broadcasters, such as yourself, are so important for providing that local content to listeners and to viewers.
Yes, and I'll tell you, it's sometimes very difficult to be here in the position of trying to keep a small station running. I definitely can identify with a lot of the others that are trying to do the same things. So we appreciate those comments. So let's go on to consolidation of broadcast ownership, which is a really hot topic right now in the broadcasting community. You know, regarding the merger of Nexstar and Tegna. For people that don't know, these are two large corporations, nationwide corporations, that own a lot of television affiliates. The FCC recently waived the rule which would prevent this merger based on limiting the national audience reach to 39% traditionally. So the merger pushes it up to over 60% of the national audience. And apparently a recent court injunction has paused this process as of press time today. Why are we witnessing an attack on diversity of ownership and viewpoints? And is this good or bad for the flow of local news and information throughout the country?
So this merger threatens to accelerate harmful consolidation in local media at a time when journalism is already under a great amount of stress. It concentrates broadcast power in fewer corporate hands. It shrinks independent editorial voices. And it places critical decisions about what local viewers and listeners see and hear farther from the community that these stations are meant to serve. And so the result is fewer voices, less competition, and higher costs for consumers as increased negotiating leverage drives up fees that ultimately will land on families' bills, monthly bills from their cable and cable-like service providers. So I've called this the billionaire bypass because that's exactly what it is. It is a procedural shortcut that benefits the power at the expense of local communities and the news that they rely on.
Do you feel that the that this will proceed? Because the two companies have already basically merged, right? And so there's a court injunction holding it back. And I'm hearing that potentially they've had to rehang the old signs and put the old graphics back on the TV newscast and things. Where does this sit at this point?
Yeah, you're right. Parties, they consummated the merger. They completed the merger almost immediately upon the FCC at a staff level approving this transaction, which to me was very inappropriate because bureau level approval of a transaction this size is certainly not what Congress intended when it gave the full commission authority over consequential decisions. When the public has no opportunity to see Senate-confirmed commissioners weigh in, then what happens is transparency and accountability disappear. So this sets a dangerous precedent. And if the media bureau, which is the staff level that approved this transaction, can approve something of this magnitude, and by the way, you said 60%. In reality, the combined company will reach 80% of the households in the country because of the way that there's certain math that's done to figure out the percentage of households. It's actually more than 60%. It's 80%, which is a huge amount of consolidation that we are seeing in the local markets. Yeah.
So the story isn't over yet, basically, is what we're hearing, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm going to hand it off to Samuel. He's got a question for you. Go ahead, Samuel.
Well, I mean, speaking about like affordability and how this affects people's bills, one of the main topics that I discuss in my work in through digital equity and digital navigation is helping people navigate their internet service provider bills and their cable bills. And one of the things that the FCC has put forth is nutritional labels, you know, putting this requirement for ISPs to be able to have clearer language and clearer, you know, messaging on their websites to help inform people what are they actually paying for when they are paying for their internet, their phone bills, and their TV bills. And one of the questions that I have is regarding these nutritional labels is, why is it so difficult to for you know, the FCC to be able to enforce these rules on companies that often go back and forth on being able to actually provide these nutritional labels on the websites? I've seen firsthand companies that have gone back and forth on being able to make it accessible. I've been in the same room with somebody and said, hey, I actually saw this and it's really great that they have it right on the front of the website, only to later on in that session say, oh, I actually can't find it. Those are things that are real issues that we handle. And I just kind of want to know what your stance is on how we can make these more, you know, visible, especially when it comes to things like making these nutritional labels machine readable so that places like Consumer Reports can, you know, make these lists that can create, you know, head-to-head comparisons between things. These are things that are affordable. And what your stance is on that and what you're doing at the FCC?
I love the fact that you call them nutritional labels because that is what they are supposed to be like. We are so used to going to our grocery store and everything that we want to buy, we can look at the back of the box or the side of the box and we can see what the ingredients are, how many calories, how much protein, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And consumers are used to using that information. And especially now that we're more health conscious today than we've ever been. Broadband labels, which is what we call them, but I'll adopt nutritional labels. nutritional labels for broadband are meant to provide that transparency to consumers that tells them, as you said, you know, how much is this? At what speeds are we getting? What kind of additional fees are we adding to our prices? Because as we know, there's a lot of fees that get tacked on top of the price of what consumers are paying. And we require it in two places. We require it at the point of sale so that consumers can see what they're buying, and we require it to be maintained in the consumer account. Now, there's a proposal to remove that requirement, the second requirement, in addition to the proposal to remove the machine-readable requirement as well. To be clear, a label that's buried in fine print or designed to confuse or is buried within a website is not a label. It's a shield.
Yeah. There's no point in having the, you know, the nutritional label inside the cereal box, you know?
Right. I love that. I'm going to use that myself now.
Great.
So, yes, exactly. What we want is transparency for consumers so that they can make a decision. It also encourages pro-consumer competition among the various providers, because consumers can actually make decisions that compare the services based on what the providers are offering. And it's not easy to try to go to different websites and try to come up with this information on your own.
I mean, this is a thing that we deal with. I mean, I've talked to folks with, you know, they're on $1,000 Social Security benefits, and they're paying $250 for a month for their bill, and that's 20. But you know, that's a normal thing. That's a common thing that I see, and they're struggling to make those comparisons.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and that's where your point about making labels machine readable matters, because that allows independent comparison tools to do the work for consumers so that they can say, here's a side-by-side of things that we have been able to see through these machine-readable formats. And the ones that resist having that do so for obvious reasons. They want to make it easier to hide the information.
You're listening to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. And if you're just joining us, this is an interview with FCC Commissioner Ana Gomez. We're talking about broadcast and internet issues that are going on at the national level, which, of course, also affect us here at the local level here in Pittsfield and Berkshire County, Massachusetts. Commissioner Gomez, back to a broadcast question for you. You've been notably outspoken in defense of Jimmy Kimmel's First Amendment rights when ABC, Nexstar, and Sinclair all decided to pull his late night show over comments about Charlie Kirk. Chair Brendan Carr's jawboning, I would call it, he's threatened to pull licenses of affiliates over this late night content. Isn't that overstepping the boundaries of the FCC's traditional mandate? And why should the FCC be involved in content regulation like this?
Yes. Well, to start with, the threat is the point. You don't have to revoke a license to silence someone. You can just have to make them wonder, if you will. Targeting specific programs and personalities by name, by a government agency, the most powerful regulatory agency in media, is not normal. It is chilling, and it is intentional. So I am going to continue to speak out against this and to keep calling it out. A free press is not a partisan issue. The First Amendment is not a partisan issue. And intimidating broadcasters is an attack on the broadcasters, on the broadcasters' rights, but also on the public's right to know.
Right. And along those lines, just as a follow-up, just yesterday, the chairman criticized CNN for reporting Iran's ceasefire demands. He described it as a hoax headline. And called for accountability, whatever that means, while the president called it a fraud on his Truth Social account. So I would guess, you know, my question there is, how damaging is this interjection to the legitimacy of news reporting? CNN, of course, not a broadcaster and not regulated by the FCC.
That's exactly right. We don't regulate cable companies. We only regulate the local broadcasters because we license them to broadcast over the public airwaves. That is where our authority comes from. But these types of threats are meant to make everyone think twice before they report anything that this administration doesn't like. And that is a clear violation of the First Amendment. And by the way, our authorizing statute, the Communications Act, specifically prohibits us from censoring broadcasters. And so threats are absolutely violating that provision as well as the First Amendment. And it's very important that we make clear that what we should be doing is we should be ensuring that we have a competitive landscape with a diversity of viewpoints. That means that we have multiple sources to receive information from different viewpoints. In this case, this administration wants to eliminate any viewpoint that it doesn't like. And that is chilling, and it's dangerous, and it's bad for our democracy. It's bad for the freedom of the press.
Right. And to follow up again on that, there was an incident with Stephen Colbert's late night show where he had an interview scheduled with a candidate for Senate, James Tallarico, which, again, as a chilling effect, CBS then pulled that interview, was only shown online. But apparently they didn't need to wait for the threat to come. They knew the threat was going to come, right? So is that what we're going to expect more of now, is sort of the broadcasters self-policing this content where they should be able to have the free flow of information instead?
I think that that is exactly the point, is they want broadcasters to think twice before they broadcast anything that might upset this administration, might get them hauled before the FCC initiate an investigation. But what we need is for everyone to call this bluff out and to push back, because whenever you see capitulation, that just frays our democracy even more. So understand, the FCC is a paper tiger here in making its threats. It cannot carry them out because it would violate the First Amendment. We do not have the right to police content that we don't like.
And ordinary people who don't like the way that's going, how do they get their voice heard? How is it that the FCC or other people in the federal government can understand how people feel about their right to free speech?
Well, I do have to say I hear about it a lot. I embarked on a First Amendment tour last year. I am still on my First Amendment tour, calling out this administration's abuses of the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press, the freedom to assemble, all of the First Amendment rights. And when I do so, I hear from communities who are very concerned about the overreach by this administration. I also hear from broadcasters, from journalists, from professors, from people just in the local communities. So it's very helpful when I hear about that. We also hear a lot just from viewers and listeners and consumers just contacting us. They can contact us in a variety of ways. They can email us. They can look on our website. There's ways to get through us. And I read those. And I see what people are saying. And a lot of people are very concerned about this.
Well, that's great. And I think our listeners should hear that and say that you do have a voice and people are listening. Mm-hmm. And again, this is Morning Drive, 89.7 WTBR FM, where FCC Commissioner Ana Gomez is our guest this morning. Samuel, I'll turn it over to you for a question.
Yeah. And speaking of, you know, giving voices to people that, you know, don't always get heard, a lot of my work in digital equity also intersects with folks in reentry, formerly incarcerated individuals, and getting them back into the workplace. And one of the things that the FCC is in charge of are the prices for the phone calls that go from, you know, friends and family of folks who are incarcerated. And that's been kind of an important topic lately. And with the recent increase that was, you know, put together last fall around, you know, November 2025, seeing an increase in costs in prisons up 83%, and seeing the costs of these phone calls. And, you know, I talk to the folks in the community sometimes, and they know that, like, the work that I do with folks who are incarcerated is often important, but often they say, well, how does it really affect me? You know, I've been, you know, following the law. Why does it affect me if we're helping folks in prison or not? And I always talk about how it's really important, not just for the families, because the families are the ones who are really getting burdened by the increase in these rates, but also the fact that, you know, the amount of money the state spends on incarcerating folks, that reflects on, you know, the money that the our taxes, right? And so some of the conversations and some of these increases in these rates in the phone bills, it was just really concerning to me how, you know, their last minute increases in November, you know, from a proposed rate in October.
Is your question, Samuel, what is the FCC's role in regulating
what
that?
What is the role in regulating that? And what can families do? What can the FCC do right now to protect families, basically?
Everything you say is absolutely right. The rates for incarcerated persons are too high, and they've historically been too high. Why? For two reasons, or probably multiple reasons. First of all, we have to remember that phone calls and video calls for incarcerated people are a monopoly service. They don't have the choice to go to someone else. They can only use the services that the prison or the jail contracts with outside providers to provide.
Right.
And so therefore, there's no competition in terms of how much these people are paying. Second of all, historically, what has happened is that a lot of these prisons and jails have subsidized services and fees, and have been provided even site commissions that are totally unrelated to the price, to the cost of providing these phone or video services. And so the Martha Wright Read Act, sorry, apologies for getting it backwards, actually ordered the FCC to take a look at the rates and to reduce them to a level where they only compensate for the cost of providing the call right. or the video service. So the commission did that, and they dramatically lowered the phone calls, the prices for phone calls and for video services. However, this administration came in and said, well, we don't think we had good data to set those lower rates. So to be conservative, we're just going to give them the prisons and the jails everything they asked for. Not the prisons and jails. I'm sorry. The
providers.
Pay phone providers. Everything they've asked for. And they increased the rates immediately. And then they said, but we'll seek data to see whether we should, in fact, change these rates. So I completely disagreed with the rate increase. I dissented on that on that order because of what you said. These rate increases hit the people least able to absorb it. The families of incarcerated people have already sacrificed enough.
Right.
So I want to see evidence that justifies these cost increases. Trust us is not an answer when families are choosing between paying their grocery bills or paying this phone bill or this video bill.
Right. And the data exists.
We have the authority here.
Mm-hmm. The data exists. It's there. The citations just seem really confusing when they're constantly saying, like, you know, we can't justify, you know, we're asking for them to justify. And they're like, well, just trust us and give us money. Mm-hmm. That's how it feels. And that's how the common person feels when we see these rates go up. And you're right. The monopoly of the prison industrial complex makes people feel really powerless. People who are already feeling powerless in a frustrating justice system. So, I want to really highlight all the things that we feel. I feel really glad that you're fighting for us on this, because the transparency is the real issue here. There's no transparency, and we feel a little bit left out. Yeah.
And Commissioner Gomez, I'd like to go to a question that is near and dear to a lot of people's hearts here in Berkshire County. And it's a question about orphan TV markets, if you will. So we're in a border area, Berkshire County, due to our historical DMA. We get our TV news from Albany, New York, which is right across the border. This prevents residents from getting Massachusetts news and sports and all kinds of other programming on broadcast. Cable providers can't carry the distant Mass stations because of network non-duplication, which protects the Albany stations. We get frequent complaints about not being able to watch Patriots games in our area. Believe me, that's a big issue here. In an era when we should be able to access any programming that we want, can the FCC offer a solution to this problem for border areas and orphan TV markets?
Yeah. Access to local sports programming matters a lot to consumers. But it's a complicated issue, as you mentioned. You know, our non-duplication rules have been in the books since the 60s. So this is a matter of both law and contractual provisions between a cable or a similar provider. So this is a complex answer.
A lot of interest
Now, I will say our media bureau just issued a public notice at the end of February seeking comment on sports broadcasting practices and marketplace developments.
Right.
So this is actually kind of a good opportunity for viewers and listeners to provide their priorities to the commission as they consider what exactly they can do about this issue. Hmm. And we can send you a link to that so you have it.
That'd be great. We'd put that on our website for sure. And I know a lot of people locally would find that helpful, because that's one of the very common things here when we talk about knowing more about the governor of New York than the governor of Massachusetts, even though, you know, we're kind of regulated by the government of Massachusetts. But we're, because we have the Berkshire Mountains in the way, we feel much more distant sometimes from Boston than we do from Albany. So that would be very helpful. Thank you. Onto a question about the current makeup of the FCC. Why do we currently only have three commissioners appointed to the FCC instead of five? Traditionally, whatever administration there is, if it's a Republican administration, there are three commissioners that are Republican or appointed by Republicans and two that are appointed by Democrats. Right now, we only have three, and you're the lone Democrat on the commission. Why is that? And then what will happen to you when your term ends in July?
As you said, normally the commission has five commissioners. We had a couple resignations last year that have now gone unfilled, which is really not good because what you want, just like we want a diversity of viewpoints for broadcasters, we also want a diversity of viewpoints and experiences and expertise at the commission level. These are very technical issues that we deal with, and having more members actually improves what we do than having fewer. So I would love to see two colleagues join me. Being the lone Democrat can be somewhat lonely, and I think it would help make our decisions better if we had a full commission slate.
But once you leave, would it be possible that there'd only be two commissioners and they'd both be appointed by Republicans?
Yes. Yeah, so it's true that my term ends at the end of June or in July. It's over. There is a carryover provision. Unless the president nominates and the Senate confirms a replacement, I can serve for another year and a half, give or take.
Okay.
But importantly, the statute requires three commissioners to have a quorum in order to act. So you wouldn't be able to have a commission with only two commissioners in order to adopt rules, change rules, approve transactions at the commission level, all the business that we do, you would not be able to do so under our statute.
So we'll keep our eye on that and see how that plays out as the months and years move on in this current administration. Again, this is WTBR's Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. We're speaking today with Ina Gomez. She is a FCC commissioner, one of three currently on the commission. And just a couple more questions for you. I know you have a busy schedule, so we'll get you on your way in just a moment. Turn this one back over to Samuel for a question. Go ahead, Samuel.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a quick question about, you know, what the FCC is doing with regards to protecting consumer data, specifically with regards to phone companies and, you know, the specifically acts regarding like CPNI with you know, there's a huge rise of AI cybercrime and robocalls. I've seen it in a lot of the discussions I've had at AI summits throughout Massachusetts, where AI companies are trying to train their data on as much of the data that they can get their hands on, including private data of people's phone calls, people's, you know, from phone companies. And there are protections that the FCC puts together. But what is the FCC doing to, you know, stand in front of that and stand in front of the overwhelming influence of AI and big tech companies?
Good question.
Yeah. So this is a systemic threat that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And AI is only accelerating it. So we do have real tools, as you mentioned, you know, we have enforcement against illegal robocallers. Every month, I feel like we have a new robocall item on our monthly meeting agenda where we're adopting new rules and finding new ways in order to try to stop these matters. And we do have, as you mentioned, authority over the sensitive call records and usage mm-hmm. data that phone companies collect about every one of their customers. We need to use all of them aggressive. Mm-hmm. These data, which includes when, how often, where you were when you actually made a call, is a telemetry. Gold mine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a gold mine mm-hmm. for bad actors. And phone companies are required by law to protect it. But AI is giving criminals new ways to exploit it, to aggregate it, to weaponize it mm-hmm. Against the very consumers that this data belongs to. Mm-hmm. So we can't allow the threat to consumers' information to be used as a training set for these bad actors. The rules exist for a reason. So this loophole hunting has to stop, and we have both the authority and the obligation to shut it down.
It's a bit of a wild west out there these days, especially when it comes to the new technologies surrounding AI and consumer privacy and things. So many things to think about. And it seems like a lot of times the policy does lag the technology to a certain extent. It's always catching up. Mm-hmm. Commissioner Gomez, just one more question, I think, for you that we have time for. And it regards just the future of broadcasting. What is the future of over-the-air broadcasting in the face of so many internet-based streaming alternatives where everybody is now moving to some sort of streamed media that they watch or listen to? Will there come a time when the big four TV networks will no longer produce original content for broadcast? And what impact will that have on affiliates and the owned and operated, their ability to deliver local news and information? That's a key source of news that we get from organizations throughout this country is that broadcast news. How will, you know, this shift over to streaming affect that? And what's the future for these broadcasters?
Yeah, I feel like much like we're talking about AI happening in real time, the marketplace shift is also happening in real time. Mm. But I still continue to believe that you can have a successful broadcasting market that includes the networks and the affiliates and community broadcasters. It may not be the money printing
The license to print money, right? Yeah, traditionally.
The license to print money, yeah. Exactly.
That we don't know what you're talking about there on the community broadcasting level.
We really see that.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing shifts. But we're also seeing consumer pushback against a la carte pricing, for example, with streamers, which is leading to some interesting, interesting pressures on the markets for both the broadcasters and the streaming companies and the cable companies and, you know, the satellite companies. I remain hopeful that actually free over-the-air broadcasting, which is so important for not just news, but also information during emergencies. Mm-hmm. That is where consumers go when something really bad happens. It's their radios, their car radios, their over-the-air broadcast stations. They're very important still. So we need to figure out how to get our policies right so that everyone can succeed and communities continue to get the services that they get through their local broadcasters, which also brings me, by the way, to public media. I think defunding public media was a colossal mistake for that very reason. In a lot of places, though, public media is the only alternative, not even alternative, is the only source of this type of information in some very remote places and places that are just not economic to be served by regular commercial providers.
Right. And a lot of that ostensibly was done through the lens of ideology, thinking that public broadcasting somehow was left-leaning. And yet what happens is when you defund these organizations, what you're going to get is more national news because that's cheaper to provide and less of the local news that's harder and more expensive to provide. But that's the thing that you can't replace, right, is the local content.
That's exactly right.
Hmm.
Well, I think
what worries me is the loss of civic engagement.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you nationalize the news, you lose all that local information about your school board, about your city council,
yeah,
about the library, about religious events, mm-hmm, about festivals. Just think of all the information that we don't get from the national networks because we have local broadcasters that are providing that information. It's really important for an informed citizenry.
And vetted information, ones that come from reliable news sources and not maybe from social media rumors and comment sections and things like that, right? The things that we're getting used to, but you can't rely on it. It's not quite the same. So those are the kinds of things that are important to protect. Well, Commissioner Ana Gomez, I want to say thank you so much for your time today. You've been very generous granting us the interview and getting yourself here in this little corner of the country.
Yep.
Of course, this program is also available by video on demand and podcast. So hopefully it will make its way out there to other folks. I think it's been a very valuable program to have for us and hopefully other people and listeners who've been watching find it valuable as well. So FCC Commissioner Ana Gomez, our guest here this morning on Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Samuel Pasquale, our digital navigator here at PCTV and WTBR FM, is co-hosted with me this morning. I'm Sean Sayre. And Samuel and I actually be back for the second half of the show, where we'll break some of this information down and talk more about some of the big issues happening these days in broadcasting and on the Internet. So again, Commissioner Gomez, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take care and have a great day.
Thanks. You too now.
All right. All right, Samuel, we'll be right back after this. Take care. Stand by, everybody. We'll be back for part two of our program in just a moment.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu.
And from Santrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Massachusetts. Retractable awnings, retractable screen, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at santrini.com.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR. And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, welcome back to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, 88.1 WSBR in Lee, Lenox, and Stockbridge. Also watching us on the PCTV Select app and on channel 1301 Access Pittsfield on your cable dial. Sean Sayre here with you this morning on a special edition of Morning Drive, where we just got a chance to talk with the FCC Commissioner Ana Gomez. Very, very informative interview I think we had with Commissioner Gomez. And Samuel, what was your take on that?
I mean, I think, you know, I've, in preparation for this interview, I listened to a lot of the interviews that she's given and fireside chats that she's had. And I was just incredibly impressed with her depth of knowledge and her, you know, ability to speak to everyday people. She's
right.
Clearly the everyman's champion, and she shows that through her words and actions on the FCC. And it was just really a pleasure, and I was really felt really lucky to have been able to get her to come to our, like you said, our little corner of Massachusetts. Yeah.
I mean, certainly it's not something you see every day. A commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission granting an interview with a small community radio station with a very small reach here. It's big in Pittsfield, but you get a little further out and nobody knows where WTBR is. I just admit that. But, you know, it's quite the thing to be able to ask her some of those questions, especially ones that affect, you know, our area and our station and things like that. And then some of the wider, broader questions that we asked. And, you know, we asked some questions specifically about consolidation of media, which is, you know, if you're if you follow these things, if you follow media and you follow journalism and things like that, you know that this is an issue. Right now that a lot of people are grappling with, and certainly the FCC finds itself at the center of a lot of these controversies. Traditionally, the FCC has been an independent commission. It's not necessarily beholden to one administration or another or a set of ideologies. And this time around, it feels like it does, like it's a little bit different this time, where it really is an instrument or a tool of the administration to force through some of the priorities that they have. I don't know that there is a precedent for that previously. Maybe there is. Maybe people would have a different opinion than I do of that, but it does seem very different this time, where the, you know, the strong arming and the jawboning that's coming from this particular FCC chair is making big federal headlines, the national headlines across every news media source that we see. That's different, right?
I think the biggest thing that we've had conversations with on, Sean, is the fact that, you know, there's a lack of understanding all over the country with regards to what does the FCC actually do? And what are they actually protecting? And what's the point? And when you get misinformation and, you know, you have overreach from, you know, a FCC chair or such, it confuses people into, like, what are they actually supposed to be doing? And it's the job of, you know, like we said, like local media and independent media to be able to give a guiding education to the rest of the country so that we can be an informed, you know, be an informed union and have civic engagement that is productive and actually helpful.
And I don't think, you know, maybe until now people have realized how much influence or authority the FCC could have under certain circumstances, right? Like, we think, okay, what are they supposed to do? They were originally created to make sure that frequency coordination on the public's airwaves, FM, TV airwaves, things, broadcast satellite, over the air type of things, that, you know, that there wasn't going to be this jamming up where one company was grabbing a frequency and another company said, hey, that's my frequency, you can't have that or whatever. So the regulation there made a lot of sense back in the 1920s and 30s when the FCC was originally envisioned and created. And also things like common carrier telephone lines, what we used to call plain old television telephone lines, which are, you know, the copper lines that most people don't have a landline anymore. But they still regulate those. Those kinds of things. And then, you know, there are other things that they regulate. Obviously, the questions that you asked the commissioner were many things about specifically internet and
affordability,
broadband access, and the kind of quality of things like that. You know, so those are areas where, okay, you know, how else would this be managed or regulated? One of the questions I didn't get to ask the commissioner, because we did get cut short a little bit on her time. It's amazing that we were able to get a half an hour with her, which I was amazed at.
And I was so nervous all week. Like, what if she just like, you know, bumps us? Like, what if she just like, oh, no, I'm too busy. I've got other things. Sorry.
Who are these people in Pittsfield? Where's Pittsfield?
But I mean, but everything else that she's been doing, clearly that's not. She's been on this First Amendment tour. You know, she's clearly, like I said earlier, a champion for everyday people.
And describe, because you're the one basically that landed this interview with the commissioner. You actually met her at a conference. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I was in the annual National Digital Inclusion Alliance's conference in Chicago this past February, and she was actually made time for a fireside chat with the executive director for that alliance, and spoke to us, all of us digital navigators, digital equity, folks, to be able to say about how important it is that, you know, people being able to navigate the internet and navigate technology is to the FCC. And I kind of tracked her down after her fireside chat and said, hey, we Pittsfield is a 3-time winner of the Trailblazer Award for the NDIA in terms of digital equity. We would love to have you on our radio show here on Morning Drive so that you could, you know, address the public. And she said, hey, well, I'm on this like First Amendment tour. We can definitely try to make something happen. And I'm like, sure, great. And I'm like, crossing my fingers, hoping that they'll email us back. And, you know, after a couple of things back and forth from February, we were able to make this happen.
That's amazing, right? Yeah. So, serendipity. Sometimes it just works out and you bump into the right people and they somehow agree to do it. And so we're grateful that came to pass.
But it takes people that really care. It takes an FCC commissioner that cares.
Right.
It takes her staff that knows how important it is. But it also takes the people that have made, you know, Morning Drive so great and has made, you know, WTBR and PCTV so great that they're willing to, hey, these guys are doing good stuff. We're willing to organize a meeting, you know. Yeah. With the commissioner.
So. Well, the other amazing thing is that because radio is still local, and of course everything we broadcast here goes to our local community, but then there are lots of people that listen to this show from different places. They've found it for whatever reason. Maybe they're, snowbirds. They are listening to Pittsfield Media, over the internet when they're in Florida or when they're in Arizona or when they're, in North Carolina over the winter, they're summering or whatever. And they stay in touch with what's going on here in the Berkshires this way. But then also things can go viral. And, certainly having a high-profile guest like a commissioner of the FCC on this program, it's certainly possible that this program will make its rounds and get out there and other people will pick up on it. I know just before we interviewed her today that you and I both watched a couple of interviews that she had done with other folks, other podcasts and other lectures and things that she had done at other colleges, places like that. So these days, that content can get around and can be useful for a lot of different people.
Yeah. And that's why I think that it was really great when, Sean, you and I have, spent the last, week or so, really trying to hone in on what are the important things that we wanted to ask the commissioner on. And I specifically wanted to make sure that I brought some shine to important things that don't get asked or things that maybe she doesn't get asked about, which is why I spent so much time on questions about, formerly incarcerated individuals and prison call costs, because I feel like that's something that doesn't get enough shine. And you might not know about it if you didn't hear it from local radio or if you didn't get an article that went viral, throughout the country. And in a time when, like you said, the FCC is making news, if you're like me and you watch the South Park, you see satire and stuff about the FCC commissioner, chairman.
Because there's this big effort right now to stifle opposing speech. I mean, I think that is the big theme that's going on here, is that if there's speech that this particular administration doesn't like, rather than just sort of, toss it off and make a joke about it or whatever and move on, this administration is more likely to try and punish those people and to try to get them off the air, as seen with Jimmy Kimmel and with Stephen Colbert and with CNN, as I just mentioned in this interview. And that's the kind of thing that, again, nobody thought the FCC would be involved in doing those things up until now. And so going forward, we don't know what would happen. One of the questions I really wanted to ask her, but we ran out of time, was about the future of the FCC and the relevance of the FCC going forward, because in the era of sort of the forced deregulation of saying, okay, we have too much regulation. It's stifling business. It's stifling corporate interest or innovation or whatever the arguments there are. And so there's a movement to say, well, maybe the things that the FCC does now should be done by other organizations or other federal agencies, you know, moving some of their technical things over to the NIST or moving some other things to CISA or, you know, the things like that, the technical things that they do. Whereas all of this stuff right now is handled at the FCC level and doesn't have to be outsourced to all these other organizations. I don't know. It doesn't seem honestly all that efficient to me to break it up into multiple different other agencies. What is it you're saving there? You know, why you're not really helping or protecting anyone or helping any innovation or, you know, corporate interest by doing that either.
But I think that, and I think that the commissioner made a really good point about when we asked her about, like, the makeup of the FCC, slate, is that she welcomed more people because it's a representation of, you know, having more commissioners means that it's more representative of the of our union, of our country. You know, we were founded as a representative democracy, and that should be reflected in the way that we create regulations as well. And I think that, you know, as I was thinking, as we were talking about these topics and thinking about them, some of them get really, really technical.
Yes.
And you know, it requires a commissioner. Mm-hmm. It requires a body like FCC with plenty of people who can intersect the very technical things of like a radio antenna,
right,
and all of those intersecting areas.
It takes very skilled staff and bureaus, media bureaus, audio bureaus, all the ones that they have underneath the commissioners. So people don't understand who we just interviewed was one of three FCC commissioners. They're at the very top of this commission.
Right.
Ana Gomez is, and everyone underneath her and the other two commissioners are doing all of this hard work. Are figuring out little things like, okay, if you're opening up a new window to allow new radio stations in, how do you do that? What are the rules? Who gets what frequency? Mm-hmm. If you've got multiple people asking for the same frequency, who do you decide which one gets it? How do you do that? Mm-hmm. Those are all things that they deal with on a regular basis, and those are necessary and needed regulations. Mm-hmm. You'd have absolute chaos if you didn't have those kinds of things. I'm sure the same is true with internet and digital equity issues, right?
Yeah. It's the same thing with, you know, the FCC is also, involved with the important things regarding, rollout of infrastructure. I mean, in conjunction with other agencies that are more attuned to that, like the NTIA, but their input is extremely important, with being able to collect information on adoption of technology and internet and phone lines and that kind of thing. All of these things require an agency like FCC that, like I said, intersects the technical like technology understanding, but also understanding communities and understanding people and like what are the philosophies and moral quandaries that are involved with being able to create that regulation.
Well, and then also not only doing the regulation that is necessary, but also knowing where to draw the line when not to regulate,
right?
Which is kind of some of the conversations that we had with Commissioner Gomez during this interview we just did, which is to say traditionally the FCC does not regulate the content of broadcasters or doesn't threaten to take their licenses away if there's some content that they disapprove of. There's a difference between doing something in the public interest, which is, okay, you want to protect children who might be listening to the public airwaves. That's the whole Pacifica case from 1973 with the George Carlin seven dirty words, right? I mean, these are things that the FCC traditionally has been involved with. And okay, so that's, you're drawing a line there with obscenity, right? You're saying, okay, that's content, but that's over the line. Whereas something like, comments that a late night host makes or a candidate for office that a late night host has or reporting that CNN does, which is not even regulated by the FCC and threats that come along with that, where, you know, corporations who might have business before the FCC, like Paramount Skydance or something like that, suddenly they're like, oh, you know, don't do anything that is going to mess with that, because that means that the president's going to get involved and suddenly our merger won't go through, or, you know, all the shareholders will not get their value back. That's really kind of what's been happening here.
And it affects things all the way down. You know, we're talking about national things, but it affects things all the way down to like the small local things, like giving equal time when we have local elections.
Yeah.
We have to follow those, you know, restrictions very closely. Mm-hmm. And it's what provides trust in the community that the things that we're putting out there is not biased. And those are things that are put forth by the FCC. Those are the regulations that the FCC puts so that everyone in radio follows those, you know, ethical regulations, mm-hmm. to be able to give everyone the chance to be able to participate in elections.
Right. Well, there's always, again, that, the license to broadcast, mm-hmm. for radio broadcasters or television broadcasters, anything over the air is always going to be a precious commodity. So they're going to want to secure that, to make sure that they're, you know, not running afoul of the traditional rules that the FCC would have. It just seems like at this point, the game has changed a little bit. So they're like, okay, well, where is that line now? Hmm. Right. And that's what she was kind of saying with, hey, the threat is all you need. You don't need to go in and take someone's license away. All you have to do is say, well, you might lose it. And then suddenly they're like, oh, well, in that case, we won't have any of this content that might cause any problems, which also means, of course, that you're losing the important content that people need to know, the public's right to know, and in the public interest, you're losing that. And kind of eventually what you get is a dumbed down broadcasting scenario where it's, you know, game shows all day. I don't know, something banal that doesn't really... hurt or potentially, you know,
doesn't challenge,
doesn't rankle anyone's feathers, right?
Yeah, it's a tough sell to folks to say that, hey, you know, radio is here to challenge your way of thinking, or because that's the kind of been the state of media. And you know, being a digital navigator, I talk a lot about media literacy, mm-hmm. and we help people understand, you know, the specific traps of things on social media, whether it be echo chambers and, you know, confirmation bias. I cover that often, and the thing that concerns me a lot that I think about constantly is the effects of AI on social media. And when social media, which has kind of become the replacement to, local news and local media, when AI starts really taking over and really, it's already taking over and already frustrated. My girlfriend complains all the time about the fact that she can't tell whether something is AI or not. And
I think a lot of people feel that way right now.
100%.
And it also, you know, not only do you not know what is AI and what isn't, it's hard to know what the truth is. And we kind of got to that question with Commissioner Gomez as well, with the CNN question, right?
Yeah.
We got CNN reporting one thing and the president saying something else and saying that whatever CNN did is a fraud. Well, so what do we want to trust here, right?
Yeah. And you know, a lot of people will just take whatever is in the, like you said, comment sections instead of, and as useful as it may be to hear real people's comments, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with comments, but there has to be some baseline. There has to be some baseline of what is, you know, reliable information,
right,
that can be then commented on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the real scary thing with, in an era where we will be flooded with deep fakes and AI, there are I can't remember the CEO or whoever is in charge of Twitter, who's really scared that, or X, right?
Yeah.
X, that's really scared that, you know, the amount of AI bots that it's going to, they're struggling to keep up with filtering through all of the AI bots and filtering through all of these things. And when people get frustrated, they're going to, I almost think that they are going to start coming back to finding, well, what's on the radio, what's on the local news, because they know that we are, and we need to be prepared to make sure that, like, when that happens, radio and local news is ready to be able to maintain our level of ethical and moral, you know, standards and integrity.
Well, because it's about trust.
Trust.
Yeah. It's whether the source is trustworthy or not. And I think everyone is starting to have to make that decision now every time they look at something, which is a healthy skepticism.
I will
say that's not a bad thing for people to say, do I believe this? Is this something that's real? Where else am I seeing this? Is this source a normal source that I'm interested in? Or is this something that looks like it was just brought to me with the algorithm, right?
Right.
And those are the kind of questions we all have to be asking. Certainly if you're listening to something on WTBR-FM and you hear our voices, chances are we are not AI bots just yet.
Not yet.
We have not been cloned. We have not been replaced by by machines or servers in the next room. So when you do hear things on WTBR-FM, you're getting it from the source. You may or may not agree with it. That's okay, too.
Yeah,
but at least it's real, right? Samuel Pasquale, I want to say thank you again for being here for the second half of the show and for bringing in the interview today with Commissioner Ana Gomez from the FCC. It was very eye-opening, very interesting to hear her perspective on how things are going with communications in this modern age. So I want to thank you again for being here today. And that will do it here for Morning Drive for today. I want to thank you all of our listeners and viewers for watching and listening. Always appreciate you. And we will be back again with another episode of Morning Drive. So take care. This is Morning Drive again, 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, and 88.1 WSBR, Lee Lennox and Stockbridge. Have a good day, everybody.